Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of May. We talk about Iraq this morning. The news from the Associated Press today says a fragile ceasefire failed to stop fighting in Baghdad's Sadr City, where the latest clashes between Shiite extremists and U.S.-backed Iraqi forces killed 11 men and wounded 19, according to Iraqi hospital officials. It wasn't immediately clear if in those killed were in the clashes, which escalated early Tuesday, were militants or civilians. There were women and children among the wounded, the hospital officials said. And according to a military spokesman for American troops in Baghdad, they are not obviously listening to any agreement. He accused what he called special groups of launching attacks on U.S. and Iraqi troops. There was word of a truce between the Iraqi government and the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr earlier this weekend, and this is a truce that is hard for us to know a whole lot about because the negotiations were between those sides and there was not any involvement in the United States. The United States is not party to the discussions. It evidently is a 14-point agreement which would impose the state's authority and security in Sadr City, end militias' armed presence in the sprawling eastern Baghdad slum, clear the district of roadside bombs and mines that the United Nations Children's Fund said has rendered many roads inaccessible. It's unclear who would abide by the ceasefire. Not all Shiite militants involved in the Sadr City fighting are members of al-Sadr's army. And so we're going to be looking at all of this, the role of Iran, Iraq, how to keep a ceasefire holding, and why it's been broken and only lasted, well, hardly lasted at all, this hour of our program. Our guest is Professor Barry Posen. Professor Posen is Ford International Professor of Political Science at MIT, Director of the MIT Security Studies Program, and serves on the Executive Committee of Seminar 21, an educational program for senior military officers, government officials, and business executives in the national security policy community. He has written a couple books. He has written many, many articles and has been a guest scholar all over the place. We welcome him to the air this hour and welcome your phone calls as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Barry Posen, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello.
This ceasefire doesn't seem to be working, does it?
Well, it's hard to tell in all these cases. I mean, these things often take a while to take hold.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what led to it. Evidently, since the end of March, there have been a number of people killed in fighting in Sadr City, haven't there? That was the reason for talk about a ceasefire?
Well, you wouldn't need one if they weren't fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So this all started, I think, when the Iraqi government decided to try and suppress the various militia groups in the southern city of Basra. And ostensibly, this was going to be even-handed. There are many militia groups in Basra, but in this case, they seem to have focused on the Mahdi army. And Sadr's movement saw this as the beginning of a kind of a preventive attack preparatory to the provincial elections that are now scheduled for the autumn. So they fought back reasonably hard, particularly given that the Iraqi government sort of bungled the preparations for the offensive. And since Sadr has people all over the country, the fighting spread as far north as Baghdad. And that's really what started the ball rolling, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. How many different militia groups are there?
I wish I knew. In the case of the Shia alone, there are three reasonably well-known militia groups. There's Sadr's own militia groups. There's a smaller group called Fadila, which is very strong in the south. And then there's the descendants of the so-called Badra Corps, who are associated with the Supreme Council, which is the other very strong Shiite political movement. It's fairly strong in the south, and it used to be rather tight with Iran. Many of its members were in exile in Iran, and ironically, that movement is closely aligned with the Iraqi government now, has burrowed into the Iraqi security forces all over the country, and even more strange seems to be a close ally of the Americans now in their strategy for Iraq. So Iraq makes strange bedfellows in terms of alliances.
I guess so. Do we know who was involved in these negotiations, these truce negotiations?
Somebody knows, but I don't. there seems to be collections of Shiite political operatives, political leaders. The Iranians seem to be involved. Some of these negotiations, the important talks happen outside the country. Sadr himself, at least, if not personally, then with his close advisors. It's that kind of thing. I mean, one thing I think is certain is the Americans are not really involved.
And should we be in some way?
I don't think we're going to be very successful if we're involved. The Sadrists, they really don't trust us. They don't like us. They've built their the legitimacy of their movement on fighting us. They view us as illegitimate occupiers. It's hard to see that you would get very far if the Americans were deeply involved. On the other hand, in a certain way, I mean, we're central because if there's going to be a ceasefire in Sadr City, everybody has to stop fighting, and that includes us.
Mm-hmm. What is the involvement of Iran?
Another mystery. One thing is clear is that the Iranians have done everything they can to improve their influence in Iraq, particularly in the Shiite communities who are their co-religionists. I mean, people should remember that 60% of the population of Iraq is Shiite. Iran is largely Shiite, but at the same time, Iran is Iranian. They're Persians, and the Shiites of Iraq are Arabs. So while they have certain common ideas about politics and about life, as people who share religion often do, they also have different notions about nation and different notions about the future of Iraq. Iran seems to have fingers in all the various Shiite factions in Iraq. So they have close relations with the government, they have close relations with the Supreme Council, they have good relations with Sadr, right? So they have fingers in every pie, and it makes life a little bit complicated for them since they're trying to be friendly with all the various Shiite factions, even as those factions fight each other, and even as some of those factions like to fight the United States, which the Iranians may like, and some are aligned with the United States, which the Iranians may not like. So the Iranians are playing a rather complicated game, but the purpose of their game of moving these chess pieces around is to improve their influence and reduce ours.
Right. Somewhere I read yesterday that Iran had played a prominent role in the deal that was struck by the Iraqi Shiite faction to end the 7 weeks of fighting. Do we have any way of knowing that?
I've seen it reported, and I have no reason to disbelieve it.
Mm-hmm. It's a situation that seems to be getting more and more complicated with every passing day. Is there anything that could happen, any countries that could get involved, any something or other that would allow there to be a truce so people would stop getting killed?
We've had truces. I mean, one of the reasons why casualties, civilian casualties in Iraq drop, particularly in the Baghdad area, significantly after, August of 07 in that area, that time frame, is that Sadr did call a ceasefire, and he disciplined his forces pretty well, and those forces who refused to submit to his discipline, in a way, he threw his bones to us and looked the other way while we went after them, right? So there was a weird coincidence of interest between us and him. Now, he stopped fighting in part because he began to believe that the fighting that his troops were doing was actually reducing his political influence and his political appeal in the broader Iraqi population. So when he saw it in his interest to turn the thing off, he turned it off. And I think that one of the reasons it's on now is clearly because he thinks it's in his interest to have it on. And I personally believe, although these things are very hard to to tell because facts are scarce in Iraq. But if you look at the pattern here, I think this whole series of fighting was really caused by our allies in the Iraqi government. I think our friends caused this, and I'm suspicious that we helped cause this. And I think what it was about is that, because of other complex things we were doing, we decided to force through a plan to have provincial elections across Iraq in the fall. And once we pushed that plan through, the Iraqi government at the Supreme Council looked at their own analysis of who would do well in these elections and came to the unhappy conclusion that Muqtada Sadr, their political enemy, would do well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they've spent a year trying to discredit this guy and have not been successful. So I think, this is my hypothesis, and some journalists have offered this hypothesis, is that this was a kind of preventive attack. In other words, we're afraid that we can't beat this guy with ballots at the ballot box, so let's try and beat him down with bullets now, particularly while the surge still has a fair number of brigades in Iraq, because American force strengths are actually going to fall as we go into the summer as the surge, runs its course.
Yeah.
So I think that the Iraqi government had this idea, and I don't think it's a very clever one. And I'm sad to say I think maybe the Americans supported it, which surprises me, because it does undercut a bit what it is we're trying to do.
Interesting. What's al-Sadr's appeal?
What's his appeal?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an Iraqi, so I have a hard time knowing what the appeal of any of these people is. What is said is that Sadr's father, basically was an important religious and political figure, particularly among the urbanized Shiites of Iraq, right? The poor, the newly settled to the cities, the young, the disenfranchised. Second, his father stayed in Iraq to resist the regime and played an interesting double game in terms of appearing in some guises to be supportive of the regime, but at the same time, we're talking about the Saddam regime here, trying to undercut it, and eventually the father was killed, right? So the Sadrist movement has a long pedigree of trying to organize the Shia, in some sense, the Shia underclass, and a long line and a long pedigree as an authentic nationalist force, a force working from within Iraq, a force untainted by close associations with Iran, which is not true of the Supreme Council and the Badr Corps, which was closely associated with Iran, right? So this is part of the appeal. The other part, I'm suspicious, is that he's a young guy, and even though to our eye, he's not a particularly charismatic figure, according to clerics, he's not a particularly learned theologist. Nevertheless, his youth and his willingness to, in some sense, stand up probably serves him well in managing this legacy, this political legacy that his father left him, right? So I think that is his appeal, and he's been very clever. I think we've underestimated this man all along, and I think we continue to underestimate him. He figured out that despite the fact that the American invasion of Iraq basically knocked over Saddam and changed the political constellation of forces in the country, and in effect, put the Shiites in a position where they could dominate the country for the first time and put the Sunnis down, what Sadr understood is that most Shiites were going to get tired of the American presence pretty quick, or many Shiites would get tired of the American presence pretty quick, and that there was an undercurrent of Iraqi nationalism that he could tap into, that was energized by the presence of the Americans. So that anti-Americanism was a smart political position, and fighting the Americans in the street with military power was a smart thing to do. Whether you won or lost the fights was really immaterial. The fact that you fought them and stayed in the game and proved that you're an authentic nationalist who wants Iraq to be for Iraquis and Iraqi politics to be determined by Iraqis had this underlying appeal for some portion of the population. So some of his fighting against us was symbolic, right? And that worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final thing is that, we have reason to believe, although again we don't know because it all happened, at night and behind the scenes, is that during the Sunni jihadi, sort of terror bomb offensives in Baghdad, where so many bombs were let off, mostly in Shiite areas, murdering Shiites, when the nascent Iraqi security forces couldn't do much, and the U.S. forces really couldn't do much. It was Sadr's militias who seemed to have found a crude and kind of nasty antidote to the Sunni bombs, which was basically was counterterror, right? Mm-hmm. So whereas the Sunnis used bombs, the Shiites used death squads. And if you remember from, you know, all through 06 and 07, where we have lots of statistics showing the increase in deaths in Iraq, you know, every morning you would read in the newspaper, you know, the bodies of 20 or 30 or 40 people were found in Baghdad this morning, tortured and then shot, tortured and shot, tortured and shot. Mm-hmm. Well, this was almost surely Shiite death squads, probably many of them Sadrists, mm-hmm. retaliating against Sunni civilians and driving Sunnis out of certain mixed neighborhoods, making it harder for the terrorists to operate. Now, this was not the end of the terrorist campaign. It's, you know, there were lots of other things that came along that gradually drove the terror. You know, the Salafists, the Sunnis, the Al Qaeda in Iraq, as we like to call them, drove them out of Baghdad, including things we did. But nevertheless, Sadr stood up and fought them, and mm-hmm. and found something that sort of worked. Right, so this also helped cement his appeal. And then there are other things, which is, you know, the in the earlier provincial elections, the Sadrists didn't participate very much throughout the South, and as a consequence, the governments, you know, local governments, fell into the hands of other political factions. Maliki's party, Dawah, the Supreme Council in many cases across Iraq, and of course, these people had no idea what they don't have. Doing. They don't know how to govern. I mean, what we know for sure is that the Iraqi government from top to bottom is entirely incompetent, right? So the people who are living in the South are experiencing incompetent government. And this has had the effect of undermining the legitimacy of Sadr's enemies. And since Sadr doesn't have to govern down there in the South, all his people have to do is claim, we have to be able to do better than these idiots, mm-hmm. right? And it appears that you know, however we're measuring opinion in the South, we have a sense that or the Iraqi government, and we have a sense that that's right. Sadr's appeal in the South is growing, and this, from the point of view of sort of just the vulgar, that narrow political interests of the current government in Baghdad, is a bad thing. They don't want to lose control of all these municipalities and local right. provincial governments. They don't want to do that. So, and there are bigger strategic reasons why the Americans might not want to have this happen. So. Sadr's been very clever, right? And he's also been a little bit lucky.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the strength and the cooperation between Iraqi forces and U.S. forces. Are they carrying on a fairly tough battle here, or are they losing it?
Well, it's the old. I'm tempted to be flip. Mostly when Iraqi forces are closely integrated with American forces, then and they meet the Sadrist militias, or they meet for the Sunni Arab militias associated with Al Qaeda, when they meet those guys in a shootout and there's lots of American support around, then they do all right,
mm-hmm.
right? When they try and act without a lot of American support around, they're not very good, right? And we know a little bit about the structure of the situation, although the American military does it a little bit to obscure it. You know, the Iraqi armed forces have no real serious quantity of heavy weapons. They don't have artillery. They don't have air power. They don't have attack helicopters. They don't have precision-guided munitions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of their heavy fire support comes from us, and you can see the way we fight the bad guys. I mean, whenever we can fight the bad guys by cornering them and then firing a precision-guided munition from out of the range of the adversary's relatively low-technology small arms, that's what we do. We don't like to have a stand-up fair fight with people. Why would you want to stand up fair fight with people? This is the gift that we give the Iraqi armed forces, because they don't have these things.
Mm-hmm.
When we're not around to provide these things, they do much less well, right? Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is certain kinds of intelligence. I mean, the Iraqis probably have some capability to gather intelligence, you know, from human beings, from word of mouth. But anything that has to do with electronics and sensors and reconnaissance and drones and that kind of thing, that has to come from us, right? If an operation is going to be complicated, so it needs, you know, lots of communications interlinks, that probably has to come from us. And when people get wounded and you want them evacuated, that comes from us. We provide the medevac, right? So, and then finally, at least to my understanding, even the logistical support within the Iraqi army, you know, the new supplies of food and gas and bullets, which even the infantry soldiers of the Iraqi army need, even that stuff is not dependable within the Iraqi supply chain. So we often are managing that. So the entire skeleton and circulatory system of the Iraqi armed forces is us, right? So we saw what happened in this Basra fight. There was either a communications failure between us and the Iraqis, or the Iraqis just jumped the gun or became overconfident or whatever. But for the first few days in the Basra fighting, they fought without U.S. or British help, and they completely failed. We keep trying to kick up dust around it, but they failed. They were beaten by the Mahdi army. But once the Americans and the Brits showed up with lots of advisors, command and control, intelligence, the fire support in particular, then the militias start having a harder time because they don't have counters to this. They don't really have counters to attack helicopters, right? They don't have counters to precision-guided munitions. So they're stuck when we get into the game, right? Mm-hmm. And then they basically go to ground, and either they decide to sign a truce or they resist as best they can in the hopes that we'll grow frustrated and come in close, right? Because it's only when we come in close that the kinds of weapons that they have begin to do damage to us. You know, the roadside, you know, mines, the directed mines, the sniper rifles, that stuff, you know, works at close range, but it doesn't do them any good if we can stand off at 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 meters or more. Then they're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take phone calls from Professor Posen, and we'll do that in just one moment. We're looking this hour at Iraq, and particularly the increase in violence in Sadr City, despite an earlier truce between the Iraqi government and Muqtada al-Sadr, and figuring out why they're still fighting despite the truce, and what role the United States, what role the Iraqi government, how many different militias there are, what end in sight to all this violence. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have one line open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And we also have an email address, which is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Professor Posen is Ford International Professor of Political Science at MIT and Director of the MIT Security Studies Program. He serves on the Executive Committee of Seminar 21, which is an educational program for senior military officers, government officials, and business executives in the national security policy community. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the author of The Warrior, A Mother Story of a Son at War. Francis Ritchie's son graduated from West Point in 1998, and just after he joined a special forces unit, the U.S. invaded Iraq, and suddenly her anti-war sentiments ran up against the reality of her son's participation in the war. When they talked, they ended up bickering about the conflict. The arguments were no longer abstract. They were tough and painful, and she has written a book of poems, and she and her son actually have been touring the country on the book tour to talk about this poetry. They could communicate very well through the poetry. She'll be joining us the second hour of the program today. All right, let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Professor Barry Posen, Ford International Professor of Political Science and Director of the MIT Security Studies Program, is our guest, and we start with David from Fenimore. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. This thing is a disaster. It's a disaster politically, ethically, morally, strategically. We have let the Bush administration escape from the reason in the first place. This was blatant, naked aggression against a country that offered no threat to the United States. It's a fraud upon the American people. It's a disaster for the Iraqi people. As many as 600,000 to a million Iraqis have died. Over 2 million have been displaced. We can talk about, you know, I mean, it's very interesting to do the analysis and talk about moving chess pieces around and how the battles are fought, you know. But this thing is a moral disaster for the Iraqis, for the American public. It's a fraud. It's a joke to think in terms of Bush being a Christian. This is anti-Christian. It's against humanity. And we ought to get out.
Professor Posen.
I didn't see a question in there. I don't mean to be flip.
Well, let me ask. Should we get out?
I sense the emotion in the questioner's voice, and I think that emotion is there in many Americans. Although I think in many more, there's just kind of a deep distress about the way things have transpired, and since it's gone on for such a long time, there's dismay and there's distress and there's exhaustion. But the anger, I think, is suppressed. I think we have a hard problem here. First of all, I opposed this war, and I opposed it publicly. I've been arguing for disengagement since 2005, and I hope that the next president, whoever he or she is, will move to disengage us from this war as expeditiously as possible. But I think we all have to understand that we've changed the whole politics in Iraq and to some extent the region, and there's not an easy way to undo this. And whether the Americans stay or whether the Americans leave, there are things that we would call bad, evil, sad that are going to happen. In other words, there isn't a way to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And I think the deeper import of the caller's question is that Americans, indeed all great powers, but particularly us, since we have so much power, Americans need to really consider very, very carefully before they start bringing their capability to bear on some part of the world to try and cause some political reengineering. Because it's easy to start the music, but it's very, very hard to stop it.
Thank you very much for the call. Let's go next to John from Madison. Hello, John.
Hello. Well, this has been going on for 7 weeks, and one of the things that's frustrated me is the inadequacy of U.S. news coverage, and that's because it doesn't fit the usual pro-government look at Iraq and look at it in terms of al-Qaeda, because it's been Shiite on Shiite violence, or Americans plus the Shiites against another Shiite faction violence. Not the Sunnis, not al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. So it's been played down because it doesn't fit the usual worldview they want to force on us. My understanding is that Maliki went into Basra with the sole purpose of discrediting or influencing the upcoming October elections. And I would like to know really what's at stake. And the reason he did this was that Sadr and the Mahdi army had purposely stayed out of the initial elections, were underrepresented, just as the Sunnis were in the Anbar province. And I would really like to understand what they're trying to do. Is it just vote suppression, or are they trying to separate Sadr from the leadership? The other question I had was, I understand Sadr represents two-thirds of the Shiites in that country, which would mean 10 million. I mean, there's 2 million in Sadr City, but I understand he really represents a much larger faction. And I would like to understand what your understanding of that faction is. And last, it appears to me strange that they're accusing the Iranians of interfering with Sadr. The Badr Brigades that have been folded into the Iraqi National Army, and especially the police, originated in Iran. And it's a kind of a farce to me that to think that the Iranians have any less effect on the Shiite forces that the Americans are embracing versus the Mahdi army. But the thing I see is the reason that they're going against al-Sadr is El Sadr is against the American presence there. I mean, who wants an invader or an occupier? You know, that's the obvious thing. But the other thing is this guy is also for central autonomy. He's not for this regional. He's for a federalized, centralized system. He's not for regional autonomy, which is one thing that the U.S. So the U.S. is in favor of that. But the main thing that they're discrediting Sadr for is the fact that he wants to get us out.
Professor Posen.
This caller is unusually well-informed. He clearly reads almost everything.
Yes.
It's a credit to him. These questions are not easy to answer. First of all, I share his frustration with the news coverage of these events. The narrative, Al-Qaeda in Iraq versus the Americans has been the easiest one for the American news media to explain, and it's certainly been a good simplifying story for the U.S. For the U.S. forces in Iraq to tell. And I'm sure the caller and others have noted that there's another simplifying story that's been told, and that is this term special groups. You know, we keep saying we've been fighting the Shiite special groups controlled by Iran, but there's very little information on who these special groups are and whether or not they really are Iranian cat's paws, or whether special groups is just our term for whatever Shiites happen to be fighting us at a moment, and it's convenient for us to blame that on Iran, so we have a kind of a double narrative going that works both in the United States and in Iraq. So we tell Iraqis, look, all your problems are being solved by two foreign influence incubuses, in your midst. It's the Al-Qaeda in Iraq that are basically funded and supported by Al-Qaeda outside, and the special groups were supported by the evil Iranians. So you Iraqis are good. Without these evildoers from outside, everything would be fine. And then you can say to the American public, look, it's just a handful of evildoers influenced from outside. If we can only deal with them, everything will be fine. Now, this is a gross simplification, and it's probably not true, but that is, it's been useful for as a media strategy both inside Iraq and outside of Iraq. Now, the second question the caller asked is sort of what's at stake here? It's an excellent question, and I've sort of spent a little time on it, trying to answer it myself, and I've consulted with some of my colleagues, and I can't really get a good answer on the what is at stake, because as I said in my earlier comments, this appears to be an effort to use bullets to substitute for ballots, right? In other words, there appeared to be a growing suspicion that Sadr would do well in the elections across the South. And if Sadr does well in the elections across the South, right, that means that the faction that we have been cooperating with, right, that's been helping us, mm-hmm. which is the Supreme Council, is going to be losing power. And Sadr, who's portrayed himself as an authentic Iraqi nationalist and an anti-American, will be gaining power. Mm-hmm. Well, whatever dreams and schemes the Americans, diplomats and soldiers and the Maliki government and the Bush administration have for Iraq, they are not going to be realized if the Sadrists control more local governments. And if they control more local governments, it's probably a good leading indicator that next time there's a national election, they're going to do a lot better, right? So this means that, again, that through an electoral process that we put in place, we would find our own strategy thwarted, mm-hmm. right? So I don't, the smart way to fight this would be to fight it in the streets, in the election. Right. In other words, and even if Sadr wins, to say, okay, the Sadrists aren't that competent, they aren't that smart. Once they're in power, they'll screw it up as badly as anybody else. So after a year or two, people will get tired of them, and things will sort themselves out. But we're on a different clock, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the Bush administration, the Washington clock, the Republican Party, the tolerance of the American people. So we're trying to drive things to a particular notion of, concept of successful outcomes. And this is all of a sudden there's this great big bump in the road that somehow we didn't understand. And how and why we didn't understand it, I do not know. And the second is, how and why would military force do anything about this? In other words, if we're going to have the election, if the Sadrists are going to be allowed to run in the elections, then shooting up members of their militia is not going to make them less popular. It may even make them more popular. And this is why Maliki has even hinted that if the Sadrists don't give up their militia, they're not going to be allowed to participate in the election. Well, I can assure you, if that happens, there's going to be a whole lot more fighting in Iraq. Mm. And this whole project, whatever the project is, the Bush administration thinks it's got going in Iraq is not going to work. Now the caller asked something about sort of the Iranians and the Americans, and how is it that the Supreme Council in Basra, which was close to Iran, is now close to us, and who's responsible for what evil deeds? Well, this gets back to the question of how mysterious the Iranian efforts are, because they are so aligned with so many different factions. I think the really strange aspect of all this is that in a weird way, on many issues inside Iraq today, we and the Iranians seem to have the same objective, right? And this is very strange and not very widely understood. And it could be I'm just hallucinating all this, but the Supreme Council, as the caller said, basically favors a highly decentralized form of government in Iraq that would really permit them to have a semi-autonomous area in the south, which is where most of the oil is, right? Now, the Kurds, who are our friends, prefer the same kind of organization in Iraq. And it appears that we've been trying to convince the Sunnis, the ones who were fighting us, and who many of whom are now no longer fighting us, that they have a future in a decentralized Iraq, right? So an Iraq in which the provinces are strong and the central government is weak seems to be an Iraq that we're trying to get. And ironically, I think it's an Iraq that the Iranians want, because this would be an Iraq that's weak, right? Mm-hmm. And I think Iran wants a weak Iraq, because when they had a strong Iraq governed by Saddam Hussein, they ended up in a great big hellish war that cost them 500,000 dead, right? So this is the bizarre thing, right? The one strong faction in Iraq that wants a strong central government that could be inimical to our interests and ultimately inimical to Iran's interests, is Muqtada Sadr, mm-hmm. right? Is the Sadrists, right? So then you ask, well, why does Iran also support the Sadrists? Well, I think Iran also supports the Sadrists because they want to back a winner and they don't know who's going to win. They also support the Sadrists because, however much we and the Iranians may agree on the wisdom of a decentralized Iraq, the Iranians also know that we're there and they want us gone. And Sadr is a good cat's paw to scratch away at us with, right? Yeah. So again, the politics of this area are immensely complicated, and it's a full time job to try and disentangle it. And it's that full time job is not aided by the great difficulties that the American media has had covering it, and I'd say the deliberate obfuscation of certain important facts that the United States spokesmen often feel like it's reasonable to do.
And should the Sadrists gain a whole lot of power in those elections, would we not, under no uncertain terms, be asked to leave?
I think there's a real risk that that would occur, right? I don't think it's a high risk, and the reason is the Iraqi parliamentary system is so fragmented. The voting system is so designed to, in some sense, dissipate power and make it difficult for any group to do anything particularly decisive. Sadr would need a truly crushing victory to be able to get enough control to sort of say, Americans out, this is the law of the land. I think it's more likely it's just, he would have enough power to essentially tie the government up in knots so that whatever it is we're trying to do is not going to happen, and that there's a lot of negativity about the American presence there. I think that's more likely, but that's enough, right? Because it basically... The Americans are chasing the dream of being able to tie Iraq up in a bow before we leave and make it look like a success. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely true that if Sadr gets a lot more power, legitimate power, through the ballot box in the provinces and ultimately in the parliament, tying Iraq up in a bow is just not something we're going to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Professor Barry Posen is our guest, Ford International Professor of Political Science and Director of the MIT Security Studies Program. We're talking about the complexities in Iraq right now and welcoming your phone calls. One line open, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now. Mike from Appleton is our next caller. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Professor. Your previous caller's question was long, and your answer was also long, and we're dealing with a very complex region of the world. So maybe if we break it down into simpler things, it would be easier for people to understand. I think the underlying thing here is the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of the world's oil reserves are in that region. And please note that I'm not saying Iraq. I'm talking about the region. And therefore, the world's economy is dependent on the flow of oil. I mean, that's a simple fact of life. Look at what we're paying at the pump today. So was this mishandled from the start? Absolutely. We should have taken a page from history and handled the situation the way the British did for hundreds of years in their empire. We didn't, so we are where we are now. It would seem to me that what we have to do is, and I really don't think it matters what all of these presidential candidates are saying about leaving. Yeah, we may leave Iraq, but we cannot leave the region because our presence there is, while it may appear to be unstabilizing, is in fact stabilizing and guarantees the flow of oil until we can find a solution for that. So it would seem to me that the smart thing to do at this point in time is pick a strongman, whoever it is, Sadr, whatever, and move our troops out of the cities, move our troops out of the line of fire, put them on the borders with Iran and Syria so they don't meddle, and let the Iraqis figure it out for themselves, whatever the result is. The important thing is our military presence in the region.
Professor Posen.
Well, the question of whether we invaded Iraq for oil, I think, is one that will, you know, the historians will have a good time trying to figure that out. But the larger point is right. The Persian Gulf is the largest reserves of oil in the world, and most of the freely traded oil in the world comes out of the Persian Gulf, and it comes out of, you know, many different countries. And the United States has more or less decided that, with the support of many others, that it has to do some order keeping in this part of the world. I think we've, in some sense, tried to do too much, but it is true that if oil is what you're interested in, there are other ways that you could ensure that in that part of the world. All you're trying to do is make sure that what you would like to do is not have Iraq turn into a big regional war, and the Americans ought to be able to manage that without being in Iraq. And second, if somehow you fail to avoid the big regional war, that you at least prevent the big regional war from being so terrible that the exports of oil from the region dry up. Now, we should remember that even during the Iraq-Iran war, in which the Americans played until the end almost no role, exports of oil did not dry up, right? There was plenty of oil exported from the Gulf. But be that as it may, American military power can play a role in ensuring the free export of oil from that part of the region. I think what we probably cannot do, and we have to think through, is and be sure that we understand this, is that most of the oil that comes from that part of the world is coming from Saudi Arabia. Obviously, America has an interest in Saudi Arabia not being conquered by anybody, although it's not clear who that would be at this point. But there's also another darker question, which is if Saudi Arabia were to break out into some kind of a civil war, what would we do? And I think what we should do is nothing. But I'm not sure that would be we would have that kind of self-control. So there are things we can do militarily to help ensure the flow of oil from the Gulf. We don't have to be in Iraq to do those. Now, the specific policy in Iraq, you know, pick a strongman. You know, Americans often talk about doing this, and the problem is that we haven't really found a strongman in Iraq who's strong enough to be able to quell the others. Muqtadir Sadr probably comes closest, but even if the earlier caller who said that Sadr enjoys the support of 60% of the Shia, which I think is probably too high, 60% of 60%, which is what the Shia is 36% of the population, which is about a third. And he's not going to be strong on the basis of a third of the population unless you do what we did with, what happened with Saddam, which is that one-third has access to tanks and attack helicopters and airplanes and the ability and willingness to use those ruthlessly to suppress rebellions by killing large numbers of people if they act up, by having a brutal police state. Now, these are all things that I don't think any American is going to support, right? So I think what you really end up doing is saying, look, if oil is our interest, there are other ways to protect it. We will disengage from Iraq on some kind of a timeline. Iraqi politics is then going to take whatever course it's going to take. There's going to be a civil war of some kind in Iraq. That civil war is going to be nasty, but it is going to help the various factions figure out how much strength each of them has, what does it cost to not come to agreements, and then gradually, you know, every war must end, they all do sooner or later, they'll come to some rough and ready kind of understanding about how power is going to be divided in the country. This is not going to be pretty, but it will be authentically Iraqi.
What are the chances of civil war breaking out in Saudi Arabia?
Nobody knows, because people don't know very much about Saudi Arabia. I think that, you know, it should give us pause that, you know, after the American invasion of Iraq, the Americans rather quickly pulled most of their residual military forces out of Saudi Arabia. But, you know, since 2003, the Saudis have fought a persistent low-grade counter-terror operation against people who seem to be sympathetic to the al-Qaeda way of thinking, right? And those people were well-armed and highly committed. Now, fortunately, there weren't too many of them, right? But it was a real brawl, and the brawl continues. Now, it looks like the Saudi government won that fight, but nevertheless, the fact that, you know, a group could get that organized and that heavily armed and that troublesome should give you pause about other possible political forces in Saudi Arabia. I mean, there have been troubles in the more distant past as well. People forget that the Great Mosque was taken in, I think, 79, and it took a massive military operation to take it back.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mysterious country, but it's a country with a rapidly growing population. Even though the country is fairly wealthy and they distribute the wealth around, the distribution of wealth is nevertheless rather unequal. The security forces of the state are, by design, there are two or three different major security forces in the state, but you don't know how those might split politically. All I'm saying is that Saudi Arabia is mysterious, and people who study Saudi Arabia, people I know, tend to be very confident that the regime is very stable and will go on forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, I used to believe that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was very strong and would go
right.
on forever, right?
You never know.
And it didn't.
Right. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Habu from Madison is next. Hi, Habu.
Yes, good morning. I'll try not to be emotional. but I do take exception to what has been said here. One is, you know, the description of Muqtada al-Sadr as radical, and I don't know what that really means. Is he radical in being nationalistic? Is that a bad thing? But it seems to kind of frequently follow him on when you read about him in U.S. Newspapers. The second thing, and very briefly, is your guest's somewhat assertion that that this, you know, military attacks and pinpoint accuracy and this precise missile targeting, etc., these things may be precise where they hit, but they usually kill women and children, and that inflames the passions of people who are left to clean it up, and there isn't as much as an apology coming from the U.S. forces. But let me make this general point. I think we here in the United States overestimate our presence in regions. We are not indispensable, and we only annoy people by showing them the barrel of a gun. The previous caller saying something about put the strongmen there and keep our bases away from the city centers. You know, Iraqis are very nationalistic, and they will not take this lying down. And let me just end with a very famous exchange, which kind of explains, I believe, the American kind of sentiment, or certainly the administration's kind of sentiment, but also the people who back him up and what have you. And this is a famous exchange that occurred between one Colonel Harry Summers during the Vietnamese-American peace talks in Paris. And this Colonel Harry Summers, in 1975, told his Vietnamese counterpart, "You know, you never defeated us on the battlefield." And the reply was, "That may be so, but it is irrelevant."
All right, we have about 30 seconds left, Professor Posen.
I think Habu was extremely eloquent, and I don't think he said a single thing with which I disagree. It's a very apt quote. It was one that occurred to me earlier in the conversation, but I couldn't quite call it up. Sure, we use words as part of the political fight, and calling Sadr a radical Sadr certainly does help in the political wars. What is Sadr radical about? He's radical in wanting to control his own country and throw us out. I didn't mean to imply that American precision-guided munitions were wonderful because they never kill wrong people, never kill innocent people. I was trying to make a different point, which is that they're really nice assets to have when you'd rather not sort of shake hands with the enemy before you fight him, and it's been a way for the Americans to control their own casualties and to achieve military success against people who are less well-armed. And this business about the United States overestimating its importance and it being able to annoy people and trigger nationalist passions, I think that's very true. I've actually made some of these points in an article I wrote called Restraint that appeared in the magazine The American Interest, and I think that article's available online, and
all right,
I recommend it to your readers.
Thanks so much for being with us. You're a great guest.
It was my pleasure.
Professor Barry Posen, Ford International Professor of Political Science and Director of the MIT Security Studies Program. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production. Thanks for listening. We'll return following the news.